a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Madam Chair, move to bonding committee.
Is there a second?
Motion
is move is to convene as a bonding committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion carried. We are now in the bonding committee. I need to, do we do a determination of a quorum? So you want to call the members, please?
Senators Abdallah, Allers, Gray,
here.
Hansen, Miles,
here.
Thiessen,
here.
Berg, Corman,
here.
Krebs,
here.
Lucas,
here.
Putnam,
here.
Rave,
here.
Tiedemann,
here.
Turgefell,
here.
And Chair.
Here. Thank you. We do have a quorum. We will begin with the South Dakota Housing Development Authority. I have Mark Lorensing. Is that correct?
Pretty close.
Pretty close. I'm sorry. Lossing?
Lossing, right.
Lossing, Mark. All right. If you want to introduce yourself, and go ahead.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Mark Lossing, and I'm the Executive Director of the South Dakota Housing Development Authority. Information that we have forwarded to you includes our annual report, our draft audited financial statements for June 30th, 2010, a list of bonds issued since the last bonding review committee, and a list of bonds outstanding for South Dakota Housing as of November 1st, 2010. Since last year's bonding review committee, SDHGA has issued $368 million for our first-time homebuyer program. In fiscal year 2010, more than $251.5 million was loaned to 2,328 first-time homebuyer families in South Dakota. The Homeownership Mortgage Bond Program continues to carry a AAA rating from Standard & Poor's and a AA1 rating from Moody's Investor Service. The authority itself carries a GO rating from Moody's of AA3, and our multiple purpose bonds have a AAA rating from Standard & Poor's. The authority contributed over $311 million to affordable housing in fiscal year 2010, including our first-time homebuyer program, our down payment assistance programs, the housing tax credit program done through the IRS, the home investment partnership program done through HUD, our rural site development program, the neighborhood stabilization program, administration of the federal rental subsidy programs through HUD, our emergency shelter grant and homeless consortium initiatives, and the governor's house program. Currently, we have 17,441 first-time homebuyer loans outstanding. In 2009, the U.S. Treasury introduced a program where they would purchase 60% of a state housing finance agency's bond issue at an index based on the 10-year Treasury rate. Because of the extremely low interest rates that we've been seeing, SDHJ was allowed to sell bonds and make available a first-time home buyer mortgage rate of 3.75% for a 30-year fixed loan. This is the lowest rate SDHJ has ever offered in the history of the program. The fiscal year 2010 average home buyer loan was $108,309, and the average purchase price of the home was $112,123. The average borrower age was 30, and the average family size was 2. The average household income for the first-time home buyers was $42,703, and 15% of the homes financed were new construction. I'd also like to provide the committee with some updated information from some of our other programs. The October Governor's House report shows a total of 1,920 homes sold since the inception of the program. 1,888 were completed, and 1,867 had been moved. In addition, we have done 75 daycares, which have been completed and delivered. The programs that SDHGA is ministering under the federal stimulus program include the Neighborhood Stabilization Program, and this program was created to provide funds for abandoned and foreclosed properties. Funds of the program are used to revitalize neighborhoods across South Dakota. For the Neighborhood Stabilization Program, a total of $17.8 million in projects have been approved in South Dakota. And we were recently informed that South Dakota will receive an additional $5 million under the NSP3, and those funds should be available in 2011. $7.7 million was awarded in the Tax Credit Exchange Program. This program is used for tax credit projects that were having difficulty in financing by exchanging tax credits for funds that were used as equity in the projects, and that also was done through the Treasury. $5.1 million in Tax Credit Assistance Program was also awarded. These funds provided funding for capital investment in tax credit projects across South Dakota. $3.2 million in Homeless Prevention and Rapid Rehousing. These amounts have been subgranted to nine local agencies across South Dakota to help with people who are at risk of being homeless. We continue to operate without any state tax dollars and continue to focus on bringing private capital into the state to develop and finance affordable housing throughout the state. That's the end of my report. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you. Are there questions? I have a question, Mark. On that rapid prevention and rapid rehousing program, are those federal dollars?
Those were stimulus dollars also, yes.
So what could they be used for? I mean, is this to somebody, what would be an example? Could you provide one, please?
An example of somebody who had either lost their job and they've got a notice that they were being evicted from their apartment. They could go and apply to one of these nine different agencies across the state, and then they could provide funds to them, and I think it's up to 18 months where they can get assistance. At the same time, they're going to have to get some counseling to help them find a job again. So it's just basically try to prevent them from being homeless and put them back on their feet again.
Just a follow-up. So how do you know that where those dollars went, how many of those people were able to make the payments and continue on in that home after the 18 months? And it's probably not 18 months yet, but what kind of mechanism do you have for tracking that?
There's specific reporting requirements that we have to make back to HUD on that also. But the program just started. You know, it hasn't been 18 months yet, but there are definitely reporting requirements that go with it.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Teason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You said it, but I didn't catch it. The number of outstanding loans is?
Madam Chair, 17,000. This is the first-time homebuyer loans. Yeah, it was 17,441 loans.
Thank you.
Over the history, we've probably done 70-some thousand loans across the state.
Representative Krebs.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mark, who does your audit? I was just reading your audit report. Who does your audit?
I.D. Bailey out of Aberdeen.
One other question. Do you have a default rate or anything on, like from last year to this year? Would you have anything?
You know, they're pretty similar from last year to this year. I think our delinquency rate is right around 3.3 or somewhere in there. Our foreclosure rate's right around 1%, which is a little bit higher than what normally it is, but I think in other areas of the country it's closer to 5%.
One last question. When you do have a foreclosure, then what happens with the property and the process that follows on that?
Depending upon how the mortgage is insured, if it's an FHA loan, it gets turned back to FHA. If it's a rural development type loan, a lot of the times we'll take that on as REO and sell it. And if there's any profit, we have to basically give it to rural development. Uninsured loans, we don't have very many of those, but there's enough equity in those to pay it off. But most of the time, we'll have to take the property and we'll have to sell it ourselves.
And then where do the proceeds go from that sale?
They go to pay for the bonds that issued them.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Representative Tiedemann, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Governor's House program, now how many years has that been going?
Madam Chair, that began in 1996, so 14 years.
And what percent of the input cost for building those homes originate in South Dakota? In other words, the raw materials. Are we buying it from someplace locally, or is it being bid out?
We bid them out, but we generally stay in-state with the bids. Now, the materials may come from out of state, like to a different lumber yard, but I'm pretty sure we use all local lumber yards and such for that.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Turbeville.
Mark, are they still building the Governor's House homes at the prison?
Madam Chair, Yes, at Springfield. There's, I think, 52 different sites that they build them on within the prison, 52 pads, I believe it is.
Any idea how many prisoners we are providing with some background with something to do and possibly a vocation when they get out?
I believe at any one time there's 80 to 100 prisoners on site building, and we also have an apprenticeship program where they can earn somewhat of a carpenter apprenticeship that they can take with them after they get out of prison and use for a job.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Great. Well, thank you so very much, and you have a happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you.
All right, we will now move into the South Dakota Building Authority, and is there a Mr. Don Templeton?
There is.
There is. Well, welcome, Mr. Templeton.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. Don Templeton, I'm the Executive Secretary of the South Dakota Building Authority. I am actually an employee of the South Dakota Health and Educational Facilities Authority. That's the report I'm going to be giving next. We have a management agreement with the building authority. Both authorities I work for also operate without any state funding. The Department of Legislative Audit recently completed the audit for the South Dakota Building Authority with no audit findings or recommendations. If you would turn to page one of the handout, it explains what we can finance, and it's primarily state of South Dakota buildings. With, in addition, we can do a conservation reserve enhancement program. So these are governmental types of bond issues. Page two shows our chairman and board members, along with our authority council. We've been fortunate. We've had board members that have been serving faithfully for over 20 years, a few of them. Page three, I wanted to give you an idea of what interest rate environment we're currently at, and it's a nice low rate. It bumped up in the summer of 08, winter of 09, but it's come back nice. Page four shows a snapshot of the past year. Yeah. We had one bond issue that we priced in August, and it had four series, A, B, C, and D. Series A was $11,400,000. These were Build America bonds. They qualify for a 35% federal interest credit for future interest expense. And we receive that every 6 months, the 35% rebate. And we've received these payments already from the government for our first interest payment. For the Build America bonds, you have to be a governmental entity. This program expires at the end of this calendar year, December 31st. So it was good timing for the building authority. The Series A financed some projects I'll talk about on the next page. Series B were recovery zone economic development bonds. $14,600,000. These qualify for a 45% federal tax credit. Now, the line that I'm showing is on the graph is a typical tax-exempt revenue rate, what we'd normally see for financing on a typical tax-exempt rate. You can see with the rebate, we get like a 2.98% all-in cost for the Series A. It's a little bit more for the Series B, 3.2%, but we went out further. It was a longer bond issue. Series C was a taxable bond issue for Custer State Park improvements. And I'll go into that in a little bit. Series D refunded some I believe it was 1998 bonds. I'll go that into that a little bit detail. The point I wanted to make is with the recovery zone bonds, the Series B, the legislature last year passed Senate Bill 50, I guess it was this year, that allowed counties to remit unused federal allocations to the state. And we worked with Bureau of Finance and Management and the counties to take advantage of unused needs from counties. And the governor allocated $14.6 million for the Series B recovery zone bonds, which produced a real nice low interest rate. And I think it's just a good example of how counties and state can work together and benefit state buildings. The building authority received some allocation for Board of Regents projects. The health and ed authority received some allocation for a tech ed that I'll go to in the next report. And then I know some cities and I believe some counties also were allocated funds. Page 6 shows the bond, what the projects were used for. The Series A was for three projects. Black Hills State renovated Woodburn Hall for $5.4 million. Dakota State had some infrastructure improvements for $3 million. Northern State, Lincoln and Graham Hall, $3 million. So these totaled $11.4 million. They're taxable Build America bonds. It was a public offering. It went from the loan was amortized over 17 years. And as I said, 2.98% all in true costs. These bonds were rated AA minus by Standard & Poor's and AA2 by Moody's. Series B was the 45% rebate, the recovery zone bonds, and these were two projects. One was a classroom building in Sioux Falls for the University Center. That was $8,970,000. Then the Human Services Center dietary building that the legislature approved this past session for $5.6 million. So these totaled $14.6 million. Another public offering amortized over 25 years, same ratings as Series A. Series C were the Custer State Park improvements. And those totaled $3,875,000. I listed the one of the main ones was Creekside Lodge. And then the we got a picture of the outdoor pavilion that's going to be in the state park. Series D and Series C was taxable because there was some private use involved with leasing the facilities to Regency. Series D was tax-exempt bonds that refunded the Series 99 bonds. Short maturity, 9 years. Present value savings, I think I put that on the graph, about $120,000. Pages 8, 9, 10, 11 and 12, 13, 14, 15 show the current balances of the projects that we have bonded for in the past. These project funds are held with the South Dakota Investment Council and earn a nice rate of return for the state agencies. Page 16 shows the outstanding bonds as of June 30th. Almost a quarter of $1 billion. Pages 17, I included a map so you could see what projects the building authority has financed in your area of the state. And then pages 18 through 21 show our total bonds from from the 1969, which was the Northern State project, Northern State College project, to our last project. We've had 73 bond issues for almost $1 billion.
Thank you. Are there questions? Seeing none, you want to move to Representative Turberville.
Yeah, I've got a question. If we could go to page 9, Game, Fish, and Parks. It's my understanding that the state of South Dakota will use, will pay, or the state of South Dakota, I'm sorry, the we will use general funds to make this bond payment, and then at a later date, this is reimbursed by Game, Fish, and Parks through sale of licenses or whatever. Is that correct?
My understanding is to be repaid from the lease from Regency for leasing out that resort for, I believe it's 10, those four resorts in Custer State Park over 10 years. And I visited with Game, Fish, and Parks, and they're ahead of their original projections for receiving lease payments. That lease has really worked out good for Game, Fish, and Parks, and part of that lease with Regency was updating the four major resorts at Custer State Park. Now, there could be some user fees, hunter user fees, and I don't know, but I think the majority, what I was told is the majority of the repayment of the bonds is to come from Custer State Park revenues.
Yeah. Madam Chair, and I understand, and that's fine. The point I'm trying to make is that the state will make these bond payments, and in the case of Game, Fish, and Parks, who receives virtually no state tax dollars, but they make these payments for Game, Fish, and Parks as a matter of convenience, and they are fully reimbursed at some later date, right?
That's right. What I understand, yes.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you. Then if you want to move to the next one.
Okay. Likewise, the Health and Ed Authority does not receive any monies from the state. We also recently had our audit completed from Ide Bailey in Sioux Falls with no audit findings or recommendations. If you turn to page 1, the Health and Ed Authority finances primarily 501c3 hospitals and nursing homes. In addition, we have financed the technical education project since 1988, and that's one of the projects we'll be visiting about in a few pages. Page 2 shows our board of directors and our chairman and our legal counsel and staff. Likewise, we've been fortunate to have board members that have been willing to serve multiple terms. Page 3 is the same 10-year interest rate graph that we reviewed previously. Page 4 shows that we've had a very busy year. In June, we priced vocational education Series A and B. These also took advantage of the federal laws that regarding the Build America bonds. $17,135,000 of these were for the Build America bonds that get the 35% refund. I'll review the projects in a few pages. $6,455,000 was allocated by the governor to be used up in Watertown for Lake Area Tech. That qualifies for the 45% interest refund. And you can just notice the difference that the governmental entities look at the lower interest rate that we, the net rate on the Series B is 3.61%, compared to like University of Sioux Falls that we financed later. Our second bond issue was University of Sioux Falls, $18 million. That was in five series, A through E. I guess that was priced in May. That was a little before the tech ed. We had a regional health $54 million bond issue, which I'll review. That was fixed rate. I'll review in a bit. And then the last financing that we completed was technical education Series C. We tried to combine A, B, and C in one bond issue, but the Rapid City facility, Western Dakota Tech, wasn't ready. They didn't have their architectural work in place to go with the earlier bonds. But it turned out the interest rate environment is a little bit lower, so it worked out pretty good. Those were also Build America bonds that get the 35% rebate. I had the underwriter do a computation of how much savings these recovery zone bonds did over a traditional tax-exempt bond issue, and it was just shy of $1 million for Series C, and the savings over for A and B combined was like $3.2 million over the life of the bond issue. So it worked out good for the technical education to take advantage of the Build America bonds and the recovery zone bonds. Page 5 shows the University of Sioux Falls bond issue that was primarily refunding existing debt for about $15.5 million, and then they had some new project costs. We have a picture of the athletic complex that was part of it. That was about $1.3 million. All total, it was an $18 million bond issue, privately placed with four local banks, different interest rates. There was a Series A that was a variable reset monthly. Fixed rates were Series B, C, and D, which were 4.35% fixed. And Series E was fixed rate going out longer term of 4.85%. And this bond issue is amortized over 20 years. I listed the fees below that. Page 7 shows the projects for the Series A technical education. $500,000 of it was for the auto shop up in Lake Erie Tech. They also funded some repair and maintenance for $700,000. Down in Sioux Falls, there was a new front entry, and they're remodeling the student services facility in the Mickelson building. That was $3 million. And then in Mitchell, they're constructing about a 67,000-square-foot student services and classroom building. That's at a cost of $11.5 million. And if you drive down interstate, you'll see a lot of steel already up on that facility, and they're starting to put block on it. These were Build America bonds, so they got the 35% federal refund and amortized over 25 years. Listed the fees below that as well. The next page, 8, shows the Series B, which is a new building up in Watertown. It's a student services building and a main entry. It's $5.8 million. That amount is $6,455,000. These are recovery zone bonds, so they get the 45% refund. They are amortized over 29 years. They're rated AA by Fitch and AA2 by Moody's. Page 9 shows regional health. This is out in Rapid City. They had a bunch of projects. The main one, I would say, would be the $5 million third floor expansion. We have a drawing of that at the bottom of the page. This bond issue totaled $54,390,000. There's public offering. It was amortized over 28 years. Regional health is rated A1 by Moody's. And then we list the fees. The last project that I have to report on that we financed was the Technical Education Series C. This is a bond issue that we just closed. We priced it on November 9th. It's got a bunch of projects. We included the drawing, but there's a new front entrance, library, welding, diesel, auto tech, customized training. The total of this bond issue was $11 million. The total new project cost was $11,500,000. The bonds were a little bit more, $12,605,000, because we have to issue a debt service reserve fund under the loan covenants and funded cost of issuance and some capitalized interest. These were Build America bonds, so they get the 35% interest refund, and they're amortized over 29 years. If you turn to page 12, we currently have three projects in the works. Prairie Lakes Health Center up in Watertown, that's refunding of I believe $22 million. Bert Olson's here from First National Bank. Is that about $22 million bonds, and it should produce a present value savings of $1.2 million for the facility. Avira Health System, we're working on refinancing Series 2008C variable rate bonds. That's about $59 million refunding. And then United Retirement Center in Brookings, we're assisting them in, we're hoping that Brookings County will issue bonds for that. It's a nursing home facility in Brookings. Pages 13 show our outstanding bonds, million of outstanding bonds. Page 14 shows map of projects financed in your area. These are healthcare. Page 15 are educational projects that are funded around the state. And then pages 16 through the end, well, that's not right. 16 through 23 show the amount of bonds that the Health and Ed Authority have issued. It's over $3 billion for about 214 projects. Page 24 and 25 show assisted projects like we're assisting over in Brookings that will be issued primarily through cities or counties. And those have totaled $36 million, and there was 34 projects.
Thank you. Are there questions? Representative Putnam.
Thank you. I only have one, and on the maps that you show, I think the answer is on the next page, but it shows your projects funded. Was there a time frame there? There's a couple on there that I thought were older, but do you have a time frame? A time frame. In other words, was it between the years of something that you're showing the maps?
Correct. Both of the maps are from the inception for the first bonded project back in 1972 on.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you so very much. And happy Thanksgiving to you.
Thank you. I'll make time for my older, some people say wiser, brother.
You know, I was going to tap into that because I'm a football nut, and yesterday they were having this between the Cincinnati Bengals, I think, and the New York Jets. The brothers, one's the coach and one's the defensive, and they were challenged on their sizes. They were both extremely, if you went on the BMI, way off the scale. And they were, and apparently their father was a head coach too, and I can't think of his names. So I was waiting to see what you look like, knowing what this person is. So you guys are much better because they were like butting each other in the stomach and playing, you know, so, you know, you're a better show than what I saw on TV yesterday.
A little bit.
Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, David Templeton, I'm the Director of Division of Financial Technical Assistance in the Department of Environment and Natural Resources. It's kind of a long phrase there, but I do have two co-workers here I'd like to introduce today, Elaine Landy and Dave Runke. They're grant and loan specialists in the program. We also have the SRF trustee here today, several representatives from the First National Bank in Sioux Falls. Bert Olson and Christy Wiedrecker are the two that I know. I'm going to be referring to the report today titled South Dakota Conservancy District. This really is better known as, the district's better known as the Board of Water and Natural Resources. And if you would then turn to about the second page in, we have the list of board members. We have a good, very good board. Unfortunately, we lost one last month, Mr. Dale Kennedy from Beersford, very long-serving board member, very, very good person. On the right of page, Roman numeral 2, is the legislative committee that's appointed to provide oversight to the board. Moving on then to the executive summary tab, a little bit of a program overview. We'll be talking about two programs today, two loan programs, the Drinking Water State Revolving Fund Loan Program, we call them SRF for short, as well as a Clean Water Program. The Clean Water Program has been around since 1989. The Drinking Water came around about 1997. They're both the result of federal legislation. And how do we fund these programs? Well, we get an annual EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, capitalization grant. And for every $5 of those grant funds, the state has to match $1. And we do that, we do the match by issuing bonds, tax-exempt revenue bonds. There's two, and they've been very successful. You'll notice about partway down page one, since their inceptions, our board has given out 426 loans totaling $686 million. There are two key program requirements. Number one is the interest rate on the loans has to be below market rate. And number two, the funds revolve in perpetuity within these two programs. They cannot be taken out for other purposes. Skipping on then, or moving on to page two, we had one issue in 2010, and that's what we call the 2009 bond anticipation notes. These are shorter-term bond issues, and it was driven by the demand of the stimulus program, or the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, that I'll talk about in a little bit. $55 million, it was all leveraged monies. There was no state match in this. And this bond anticipation note issue received the highest ratings by Standard & Poor's and Moody's for short-term debt. There was a financial team put together, and it was a competitive sale on these notes. The First National Bank was a trustee. We had Bruce Bonjour with Perkins Coie, who's been a longtime bond counsel for the board, does an excellent job, and a financial advisor called Public Financial Management. I think I'll skip over the 2008 bond issue. I think you probably heard about that last year, but I would like to give you an update on the stimulus program and the stimulus monies. Our SRF programs on the drinking water side, they received $19.5 million of stimulus dollars. The clean water, $19.29 million. There was no state match required, so these were pure federal funds. Staff had to scramble because we only had 1 year to have our board award the dollars and then have the recipients bid the projects and get the monies under construction contract. And that deadline was February 17th of 2010. I'm really happy to report that we did not lose any dollars, none reverted. Everybody met the deadline. And so we're busy now moving through those projects. There's been, as of late October, about 68% of the clean water funds have been drawn by the communities, and 87% of the drinking water monies. There was a requirement that at least 50% of these monies be given as additional subsidy. And by additional subsidy, the federal government meant grants, zero or actually negative interest rates or principal forgiveness. Due to a couple of reasons, our board chose principal forgiveness. An example of that would be if we, if the board gave Watertown, let's say, $1 million with a $400,000 principal forgiveness portion, the city only has to pay back the $600,000. So it's basically a grant, but it's we can't call it that because there's more paperwork required if we do. We made a decision early on to give everybody that we ended up giving stimulus monies to an automatic 10% as stimulus, and depending on the need thereafter, we gave some as much as 100% principal forgiveness. You go to the top of page four, it worked out very well. We were able to fund with a board 68 different projects. So I think we got everybody funded from the size of Sioux Falls all the way down to some of our smaller systems. We more than met the 50% additional subsidy. We were more like at about 82% as principal forgiveness. So I think that program worked out very well. There's a couple other requirements that were new to us with this program. There's a green infrastructure requirement, and we had to spend 20% of our monies on those types of projects. We were able to do that. There was Buy American and then Davis-Bacon wage rates. And Davis-Bacon wage rates are or is a requirement that the contractor pay their workforce certain minimum wages. We did receive 2010 capitalization grants in the middle of page four. That followed the stimulus. They continued on with the Davis-Bacon wage rates. They kept that in there. The green technology was kept in there. And there was a smaller requirement for principal forgiveness or additional subsidy that also stayed in the new dollars. So we're going to use the principal forgiveness option in the future as long as it stays in as a requirement. On middle of page five, on table one, there's a summary of the different bond issues and note issues by the district since the program inceptions. There's more detail on each one of these issues if you go back on page 75. A couple things, or one thing I want to just note on the table one, the SRF leverage columns, if you add those up, there's about $163 million of leverage bond proceeds that were issued. And the reason we issued that is, or those leveraged issues is that we had more demand than we had money, money being the capitalization grant and the state match. The board's never had to turn anyone down due to lack of money. If we need money, we'll go out on the market and get it because we have such a strong financial, the programs are in such strong financial shape that we can do that. Towards the bottom of page five, as far as the interest rates, you notice that they're 2.25% for 10-year loans, 3% for 20. And then the different programs each have a 30-year loan option, but there's different requirements. On the drinking water side, if you're disadvantaged, you can get up to a 30-year zero-interest loan, and we've made several of those if you're under the 60% of medium household income in the state. So those are our interest rates. As far as program oversight, legislative audit does an annual audit of each of our programs. We've had very good audit results. We haven't had any findings in 10 or 12 years, and they're actually starting one right now. We also get program people from the Environmental Protection Agency and to come out and make sure we're following program requirements. We also had EPA headquarters in Washington, D.C. with the stimulus money. They put a lot of importance on those dollars. Beginning, on page seven is the program activity, the loans that were made on the clean water side in 2010. It was 18 loans and two loan amendments totaling almost $42.5 million. On page nine, and in that there's a table who received the dollars. On page nine is a drinking water summary, and that was 20 loans totaling $22.6 million. And then moving on, and there's another tab called financial statements. We have one both for the unaudited for the clean water and the drinking water side. And then the next tab is this Clean Water SRF Program information. That has a history since 1989 of what capitalization grants we got, which how much our state match was, who got the money, and et cetera. There's also a following tab on the drinking water. It gives a similar summary of all the programs activities since they started. And then we kind of... And then the next tab is that summary of the different bond issues we've had since program inceptions. And lastly, our statutes regarding the district and the SRF programs. And that concludes my presentation. Madam Chair, stand by for any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Well, very good. No questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, and happy Thanksgiving. Okay, we will next move to the South Dakota Value Added Finance Authority. And we're not sure who's going to present, so when you come up, identify yourself.
Okay. Madam Chair, committee members, Cody Richter, grant and loan specialist for the Department of Agriculture. The Value Added Finance Authority administers three bond programs, the Beginning Farmer Bond, the Livestock Nutrient Management Bond, and the Agribusiness Bond, and also our direct loan agribusiness relending program. Since inception of the Beginning Farmer Bond, we have done 313 bonds for a total of $36 million. On page 8, it's a detail of the five bonds we closed in the last fiscal year for a total of $1.4 million and an average interest rate of 5.43%. Since inception of the agribusiness bond, we've done seven bonds for a total of $19 million. We did not close one in the last fiscal year. A livestock nutrient management bond, we have done 21 bonds for a total of $9 million and also did not close one in the last fiscal year. For the value-added relending program, since inception, we have done 22 loans for a total of $1.7 million. We closed two of those in fiscal year 10. Both at 3%. And our board member, we have a seven-member board, Chairman Robert Hall out of the Sisseton area. And starting on page 26 and 27 are the financial reports for the Value-Added Finance Authority and also the Value-Added Relending Program. And that is the end of my report.
Questions? Representative Cronin and then Representative Lucas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just trying to go back and find where I was. Pages 8 and 9, I suppose 10, 11, all the way up to 13, you go back to 96 was the first, looks like the beginning of the Beginning Farmer Bond Program. And I looked through all the years up till this last year, and the highest amount you gave was $250,000 for one of the beginning farmer loans. But in 2009, you crept over the $250,000 mark all the way up to the $450,000 mark. I was just curious if you can tell me why that happened.
Madam Chair? The maximum bond amount is set federally. And in that year, the maximum amount went from $250,000
to $450,000. Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question is just simply your interest rates seem to be higher than the Housing Authority and in this low interest rate of recessionary time. I was wondering why that is.
Madam Chair, the interest rate... for a bond is set by the lender and approved by our board. Usually it's about, with land purchases, our bonds are about a 1% to 3% deduction in the interest rate. So, for example, the lender might be at 7.5% without a bond and go down to 5% with the bond attached.
Any other questions? Okay. We were just commenting here. Last year when you came before us, you said you were in your job 3 months or something like that.
Yes.
So now you've got a whole 15 months. Very good. Answered well.
Thank you.
Happy Thanksgiving.
You too.
Great. All right, then we'll move to the South Dakota Economic Development and Finance Authority, and I believe Mr. Michael Youngberg. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senators and Representatives. Thanks for your time today. My name is Michael Youngberg. I am the Finance Manager for the Governor's Office of Economic Development and representing the Economic Development Finance Authority today, which is one of the Board of Economic Development boards that we report to. First turn to the opening page for a summary of the Authority's operations and accomplishments. As a side note, you do see that there is also the APEX fund there, which is a agricultural processing and exporting loan program that the authority does oversee to issue approved five new APEX loans for about $653,000 last year. And just below that, we did approve two new pool loan bond issuances for $7,605,000 in fiscal year 2010. If you'll turn to page 6 in the debt administration section down there, it does show the series 2009 A and B bonds that were issued in fiscal year 2010. We did issue $3 million in bonds that were for that issuance, which was approved in fiscal year 2009. On pages 7 and 8 is a summary of balance sheet and income statement. EDFA's net assets increased by about $106,000 in fiscal year 2010. That was mainly a result of investment income. This amount was actually lower or down than we've seen in previous years. We typically see that investment income cover most expenses. This year did not, so expenses were a little bit higher than investment income that was generated, very likely a product of the economy and the investments that the cash is invested into. Page 14 is a schedule of the outstanding notes and bonds. Currently, there's $22,905,000 outstanding. That is backed by the EDFA pooled loan bond program. We have the capacity to go up to $40 million based on the capital reserve fund, which is the money that's set aside directly to back these up. That's $5 million. Our authority can generate a multiple of 8 times basically what's sitting in that capital reserve fund. So $5 million gives us $40 million. We do have approximately another $17 million approved, So if those were to fund, we would be pushing up on those limits. Back to page 13. One payoff, bonds retired in fiscal year 2010 for $2,700,000. And then information on our professional services. Clausen and Rice does perform our accounting for us. We did do a request for a proposal for those services a few years ago. I contacted all the local area accounting firms. Unfortunately, we only had one response, but they've been done a very good job for us, so we do appreciate that. First National Bank, Sioux Falls, who has been mentioned here before, also does act as our trustee on the pooled loan bond program and does loan servicing for our APEX program, which I alluded to a little bit earlier. We do use Dorsey & Whitney as bond counsel, and Doherty & Company has underwritten a majority of our issuances that we have done in the past. The EDFA bonds, all series, do carry the Standard & Poor ratings of A, which is attractive market out in the rate. Each issuance carries its own interest rate, which is dependent on the market at that time. Currently, we're seeing rates on tax-exempt bonds sub 5%, up to 20 years on land and building, about 10 years on equipment. So as we see banks and other private lenders pull back, it does become a program that can offer a long-term alternative fixed-rate financing scenario for the prospects companies that we are looking at bringing to South Dakota and helping a lot of the South Dakota companies in here are ones that are existing and expanded. Just a update committee on our board members. We do have a 7-person board. It was only a 5-member board until a few years ago when we changed that. That board is made up of the chairman, Terry Nelson, from Rapid City, Garrett Jufer from Wagner, South Dakota, Mike Keller, Dean of Business School from Vermilion, Casey Durflinger from the Hot Springs area, Jody Spurlick from Rapid City, George Lund from Sioux Falls, and Steve Hayes from the Presho Pier area. Are there any questions?
Thank you. Are there questions? Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gray.
We're being pretty easy on all these guys. I wonder if we should have them back for every e-board meeting. That'd be okay?
Thank you. Any other constructive comments? Or With that, I say thank you and happy Thanksgiving to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your time today.
We have heard from all the boards now with their reports.
You just need a motion to accept it.
Right. Yes.
Madam Chair.
Representative Krebs.
Move to accept the reports from all the bonding committees. Authority.
Okay. It's been moved by Representative Krebs, second by Representative Rave, to accept the board reports as presented. Any discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor of the motion will say aye. Those opposed, nay. Or can we just do a voice vote? All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. I'm looking for my gavel. Motion carried. Thank you again for coming. Yes.
Madam Chair.
Representative Krebs.
May we adjourn as a bonding committee and go back into and reconvene as the executive board?
Is there a second?
Second.
Moved by Representative Krebs, second by Senator Miles to discontinue as the bonding committee and reconvene in the executive board. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion carried.
Moving on here for the e-board, we are at the review of the Bureau of Age Administration. So do we have a report from BOA? Representative Senator Rave, you have a report as chair?
I do, Madam Chair. Thank you. This summer, we had the task of doing sunset review on the Bureau of Administration. I have to tell you up front, it didn't come off as a lot of flashy stuff, but it was an extremely informative summer. We spent time at Fleet Management. We spent time at Central Duplication or Printing. The off-site visits were very informative. Up front, I want to thank Commissioner Bloomberg for his accommodations. We had to switch around the schedule a couple times, and I know those folks were prepared for having us, and that they were very gracious in accommodating our schedule. You know, like I said, we really went through everything that BOA did. Some highlights: they do have 174 basically FTEs and a budget of about $35 million. I won't go over the report because you all have it, and it's not that long. It wouldn't take you that long to read it. At the end of the day, we did decide to keep on BOA, decided not to sunset them. They fill a very, very, very little recognized but absolutely necessary function in the ongoing work of state government. They don't get recognized a lot. Like I said, it deals with cars and duplication and buildings and grounds and et cetera, and all the things that we just take for granted. They were very diligent in finding efficiencies in the way that they have done things from the past, going forward, understanding of the restraints, the fiscal restraints that we are going to be working under. I was extremely impressed. I know the committee was as well, and would certainly be open for any other comments from committee members. But really, we only had two pieces of legislation. One was strictly a style and form that updated some of the statutes that date back many, many years. And really, the only one of any interest or excitement was the discussion regarding the state seal and the overall oversight of that and who will allow that to be utilized in different capacities. And at the end of the day, we decided that it would go back to the Secretary of State's office, where probably some of us that have been in the legislature a while remember it, the oversight being originally now back to the Secretary of State. The commissioner had taken it over for a few years ago. So other than that, they were just very gracious in opening up their books, their time. We had some very good discussion about whether or not to keep them going or not. And actually, I believe it was Representative Kirkaby just asked him the question, why should we keep you? And Commissioner Bloomberg was very gracious in answering that and did a good job and a lot of good data on why we should keep BOA around. So I stand by for any questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there questions? Representative Putnam.
I don't have a question, but I'd certainly echo what Representative Ravis said today about the review. There was a couple of us here on this committee that served with him on that, and he did a great job, he and Senator Haverly, in keeping this moving. You know, it's strange in a way, because when you hear the title BOA, or the Bureau of Administration, you really are misled. And the things that we learned with regard to, they handled all of the motor pool, all of the vehicles, salvage of every piece of equipment that, you know, comes and goes within state government and what they do with it. I think it educated many of us, and certainly myself, who'd been here a number of years, but just educated us as to exactly what they do. The administration piece of it kind of leads you to believe they have something to do with typewriters and paper, but that's not true at all. But I, again, too, want to thank Representative Raven, also Senator Haverly, for doing a good job. And we got through it, and we did have some great legislation come from there that will correct a lot of the situations. And thank you for doing that. Thank you, Representative Raven.
Yes, Representative.
If I could, I would be wrong if Sue is back in here. Sue kept us on task and did all of the actual hard work. We showed up a lot and talked. But thank you, Sue. We couldn't have done it without your help. So thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Thank you. We will move then to the Code Commission.
Good afternoon. I'm Doug Decker. I'm the Code Counsel. I staff the Code Commission. The Code Commission is a statutory commission. It consists of five members. Two members are appointed by the legislature, as I note in the report, one by the Speaker of the House, one by the President pro tem, and both of those members will need to be replaced as a result of the election this year. The other members of the commission are Mike Demersman, who is the chair. He is appointed by the executive board of the Legislative Research Council. And then you have Tom Lee, who is appointed by the state bar. He's a lawyer here in Pierre. And Lee McCarron, also appointed by the state bar. He's a lawyer in from Vermilion. And their terms are still effective. The Code Commission primarily is responsible for the publication of the code and securing the publication with a private contractor such as West Publishing, who is the current publisher of the code. Prior to that, it was Mickey, and then there was a series of other corporations before that. We renew the contract for the publication of the code on an annual basis now, and it comes up it expires every June 30th, and we renew the contract at the beginning of the legislative session. So we have a lead time to talk with the West and members of the bar to see if they have any interest in any changes. The other thing that the Code Commission does is authorize the publication of replacement volumes for the code. One of the reasons they're involved in that is because the pocket parts from the legislation that is passed gets to be too burdensome to be placing in the back of a volume. It gets awkward, so you replace the volume, you reprint everything into the main volume. And it gets to be a budgetary issue for people who buy the code, because you have to buy the replacement volume. That's why the Code Commission is involved in that. They want to update the code on a regular basis so that there is not a year when there were a person would be required to replace say, five volumes of the code as opposed to one on an annual basis. It makes it easier to manage. The other thing that the Code Commission does is authorize, or through its contract with the publisher, it is the Code Commission that provides the discs, the law on disc, to the legislature, and that's part of the contract, and that it gets renewed annually. And with that, we have one piece of legislation that we usually sponsor each year, and that is to codify the previous year's legislation. In effect, it moves it from the session laws into the codification. And that would be my report.
Questions? Oh, Representative Putnam.
Yeah, thank you. In the on page, I hope I'm on the right page. Page 9 said something about a bill being proposed on interim rules review. Am I reading that correct, or am I on the wrong page? Okay, I apologize.
That's a later report. I can give it now.
Thank you. Well, I'll wait. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Oh, he's already. Okay, we will now move to DENR.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the Executive Board, Aaron Olson with the Legislative Research Council. Senator Tom Hansen, the chair of this committee, asked me to present the report to you today. He just didn't think the travel voucher was worth coming to town for a few minutes for the report. Wishes he could be here, but thought that the written report would be sufficient. The committee met three times this summer. July 21st meeting was held in Pierre. Secretary Perner and his two division directors and nine program administrators attended the meeting and presented a lot of detail to the committee regarding the missions and the programs within the department. Some of the programs that were touched on were Water Resources Assistance Program, the Geological Survey Program, Air Quality Program, Drinking Water, Groundwater Quality, Minerals and Mining, Surface Water Quality, Water Rights, and Water Waste Management. Excuse me. At the second meeting, it was held on August 24th in Pierre. The committee heard testimony from the department regarding some follow-up responses and questions from the first meeting. They heard Tom Megadens from LRC presented a draft of the foreman-style cleanup legislation that was ultimately passed at the third meeting. Tom spent a very significant amount of time reviewing the DNR's code this session, and as a result, you'll have an opportunity, assuming the report gets approved, to see a 230-page bill this session. We did have a public hearing on the second meeting. We had nine members of the public show up and testify, so we did have a good public hearing. And at the third meeting, we met during teleconference and approved the style and form bill, and that was basically all the business that the committee had at the third meeting. Representative Tiedemann and Representative Lucas were both on the committee. If there's no questions for me, I would open it up to them if they have anything else to add.
Thank you. Comments by either of you?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I think it was a very thorough review. The thing that I came away from is that the department does a lot of interaction with other departments, Department of Ag, Department of Health, Economic Development. So it's very intertwined, I mean, because we take for granted our quality of water in this state and our quality of air. And when people travel here, that's something that they really appreciate. So it ties into even tourism. And, of course, with our water quality, the Department of Health, testing, those types of things, and the waste management, tying back to the feedlot operations and that type of thing. So there was a lot of interaction that went on between the other departments, even though they weren't here at the table. So it was a very good review.
Madam Chair, and at the end, like in the BOA agency review, the committee did choose not to sunset the department.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Okay, Representative Lucas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The point that I would add is we did get to tour their facilities across the street in, is it the Anderson Building? And that was quite interesting to see how they collect the data with the air and water testing, and do feel pretty comfortable that we are in good shape in South Dakota, even though there's some that complain about the EPA and some of the regulations that are imposed upon us. In the long run, I don't think we want to go back to some of the standards we had back in the 70s where we had open burning and landfills and very little groundwater monitoring and things along that line. So if you sit back and look at all the regulations that have come down into play, most of them, I think we'd all agree, are very worthwhile and beneficial to the public.
Thank you. Representative Cronin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Was there any discussion, and maybe it didn't fall under the scope of the review, of the tiling in the eastern part of South Dakota? There's some problems with that. Was that addressed? I just remember when we left session last year, that was one of the requests of the department review when we talked about it.
I actually can't recall that it was discussed unless...
Representative Tiedemann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, it was discussed. Okay. It was brought up, but that, again, falls under the jurisdiction of the county. And so it's a local control issue. The issue that I brought forth, in fact, was a situation where the one producer is located in one county and the person that's receiving the lack of benefit of the drainage is in the other county. So that's where you have an issue that cuts across the boundary that doesn't solve the problem. And the secretary said that he would be willing to listen and visit with the people that were impacted, but the statute is in place that you cannot negatively impact somebody else. Of course, the situation was exacerbated this year because of all of the rainfall that we had, and some years you'd be thankful for some of that water trickling on your land. This year it wasn't any thanks at all.
Thank you. Any other questions? No. All right. Thank you very much. Next, we'll move to government operations and audit. I know Tim Flannery is here, and I also know that Senator Thiessen chairs that committee. So,
good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Tim Flannery with the Department of Legislative Audit. I serve as a member, a staff member assigned to the Government Operations and Audit Committee. The report prepared for you is comprised of two elements. The first is the responsibilities of the GOAC Committee. The second is the activities of the committee for calendar year 2010. The 10-member statutorily created Government Operations and Audit Committee's responsibilities include inquiry and review of any phase of the operations and fiscal affairs of any department, institution, board, or agency of the state, and the review of operations of state's correctional system, including review of abuse or neglect in juvenile corrections facilities. During the year, the committee was active in reviewing juvenile corrections issues. The committee reviewed the semiannual juvenile corrections monitor reports prepared by the Department of Human Services on substantiated and unsubstantiated cases of abuse and neglect involving juveniles in custody and care of the Department of Corrections. The committee also received and reviewed the semiannual report on alleged abuse and neglect of juveniles in private contracted facilities, which is prepared by the Department of Corrections. In addition, committee members individually or in groups of two visited 15 different juvenile facilities across the state. The list of those facilities can be seen on page 7 of the annual report. The committee asks that the Department of Corrections report in the future on the success rates or outcomes when the juveniles leave the respective facilities. The committee reviewed the State of South Dakota's single audit report, which includes the complete set of financial statements of the State of South Dakota and the schedule of findings and question costs for various state agencies. This schedule of findings included 21 recommendations relating to inadequate internal control procedures over receipts, revenue collections, expenditures, and financial reporting. 7 recommendations related to violations of federal laws and regulations, and 1 recommendation relating to a state compliance issue. The committee requested that 1 agency appear and respond to various audit findings. Corrective action included agreements by agencies to improve internal control over administering various aspects of external financial reporting, agreements to develop better accounting policies, the implementation of a reconciliation template to better reconcile a payroll system to the state's accounting system, and agreements to improve internal controls over construction change order processing. Various other activities of the committee during the year included the review of annual general fund contract carryovers. The committee selected 11 contracts to look into more closely. This is an ongoing project of the committee. The committee reviewed activities involving the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act funds received by the state. The committee continues to review the operational aspects of state programs receiving stimulus money. The committee received an update from the Department of Social Services on the status of the implementation of the new Medicaid Management Information System. The Department of Social Services also provided information on their role separately and in conjunction with the Department of Corrections regarding matters concerning juveniles in private placements. The committee heard from the Department of Tourism and State Development on the Governor's $1 Million Challenge Program. The department explained the intent of the program as well as the criteria for participating in the program. The BRAM board provided information to the committee on fees charged by the board. The Department of Transportation reported to the committee on 2 topics, 1, the usage of state-owned airplanes, and 2, the information on railroad authority loans outstanding. The committee heard testimony from the Department of Health about the rollout, distribution, and administration of the H1N1 vaccination effort, as well as the recalled vaccines. The Department of Human Services reported to committee on 2 topics, 1, the Medicaid-Medicare billing process, and 2, the maintenance and repair projects at the Human Services Center in Yankton and the South Dakota Developmental Center in Redfield. The committee heard from the Department of Corrections on the status of the Rapid City Minimum Security Facility. The Department of Education appeared before the committee to explain the student enrollment process for the purpose of computing state aid provided to the school districts. The Attorney General's Office reported to the committee on the types and amounts of settlements received by the state over the last 3 years. The committee received a citizen's complaint regarding the extended length of time it takes to license an aerial applicator. The Department of Agriculture provided details about this particular licensing process and explained improvements to be made to accelerate the licensing process. GOAC received and reviewed specific information from the Department of Corrections on out-of-state juvenile placement facilities. And lastly, numerous miscellaneous areas and concerns raised by current events or individual committee members were looked into. That's my report, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Teason, do you have any comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of follow-up notes. I think one of the primary functions of GOAC is to monitor the juvenile monitor that the legislature put into place a few years ago when tragic circumstances in our juvenile corrections. We spent, I think, a fair amount of time on that this year, including in lieu of having a GOAC tour somewhere in the state, we divided up into pairs. And as Mr. Flannery mentioned, we visited 15 of our contract facilities around the state, places where we spend millions of dollars, both Department of Social Services and Corrections, in placement of juveniles. Many of those facilities had not been visited by legislators since the tragic times, 8 or 10 years ago. So I think it was worthwhile for us to conduct those visits, get some eyes on those entities. As well, I can tell you, at least from my point of view, I've looked very, very closely at this juvenile monitor situation since I've joined the legislature. And it appears to me that that system is working very well, that we have a good employee doing that work. We have he's very dedicated in collecting information and investigating reports. I think the Department of Corrections has been very cooperative throughout that process. I get to see that not only from GOAC, but also from the Corrections Commission point of view. We've inspected facilities, our state facilities, for example, down at Custer. Every dormitory has a lockbox. I've taken juveniles from the facility aside quietly and asked them, you know, what's that box there for? What is it? What's it intended for? They all know. They've all been briefed on how to file a complaint, how to report problems. I'm just very confident that we have a good system in place. Obviously, it's not foolproof, but you should be very pleased. Those of you that helped institute that system a number of years ago, you should be pleased about how it's working, and I think we have a very good additional layer of protection in juvenile corrections in the state. I would say that in the course of this last year, we had two cases of confirmed abuse in our state juvenile correction system, and I can tell you, as a former law enforcement officer, that makes the hair on the back of my neck stick up, and I pay attention. Fortunately, well, while neither of those circumstances, neither was appropriate, and both required immediate attention, neither of these resulted in any serious or significant injuries to the juveniles involved, and fortunately, they were both dealt with very quickly, very professionally by the Department of Corrections, and neither of the employees that were involved in those activities are any longer employed by Department of Corrections. So I think the system works well as far as I can tell, and we should be proud of the fact that we have that additional level of protection in our system. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Possibly a question and comment. First of all, I can certainly understand working with juveniles on that particular committee, and I've never served on that committee. But with regard to executive sessions and them being certain ages of situations that you might be talking about, my question would revolve around the fact that the Government Audit and Operations Committee could also look into, let's just say, for example, the revenue expenditures of a drug task force. Would that be a reason to not have a public hearing? I mean, how do you control that? You certainly, on the audit side of things, must know those rules and regulations. And when we go to that committee, when they close those hearings, are there some sort of a substantial standard or open meeting law that can, you know, that actually agrees with what you may do there?
You know, Madam Chair. We do look at the other funds. That's another fund of state government, and the Government Operations and Audit Committee has asked them to come and explain the sources and uses of fund within that other fund. I don't know that it's been a while since we've actually audited that other fund in detail. I'm not sure if I answered your question.
Well, I probably did. We might not know. That's what I would, you know, and a couple of times I happened to be in Pierre when there were closed hearings, and then I realized then what it was about. And certainly that, under the law, I mean, I think that's pretty black and white. But I was wondering, because you are audit folks, you are auditory, what part of the open meeting law doesn't apply? I mean, in some cases, situations might arise that would require life and limb risk. So I was just curious. I didn't mean to start something up, but it was just on my mind when you talked about juveniles and mm-hmm. having hearing. But thank you for the answer.
Senator Thiessen.
Thank you. Just to clarify, the only time that the Government Operations and Audit Committee goes into executive session for a closed hearing is if we find it necessary to discuss one of these abuse and neglect cases to the extent that it would be necessary, that it might compromise the identity of the people involved. And I'm trying to think whether we actually, did we go in one case, went into executive session so we could discuss details. But the general the general summary is discussed in open session, and we have very limited executive session, only when greater detail that would compromise identities involved. Thank you.
Representative Lucas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question on a different topic. It's with the school aid formula and the count of the students. Last year, there was an error that came into play after the governor's budget address. And then when their budget came in front of the Appropriations Committee, the count numbers were off from what they had submitted earlier. And in your report, it says that there's new procedures put into place for this school year. It doesn't say what those are, and it says no further action was deemed necessary. So can you briefly explain how those new procedures are for the counting of the schools to get the correct number of students?
If I recall from Department of Education's testimony, there's an accounting system, or I'm sorry, a computer system in place that the state has access to, that the schools essentially will, on a certain given day, log in their student counts, and the state can see that and monitor that. They do some internal procedures to double check for duplicate students being recorded. So I believe it would be described as a few more controls on that computer system for documenting the kids in the system.
Go ahead.
Last year, then, was the mistake more with the department, our Department of Education, that they just didn't double check the numbers the schools had sent in, that there were duplicate numbers in there, or were some of the schools trying to massage their numbers a little bit to their benefit, you know, counting students that were there part of the school year, counting them as being there for the full year, for example?
You know, I don't actually recall the Department of Education testifying on that session item. So.
Representative Turberville.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I also serve on the GOAC committee, and I have to agree with everything that Senator Teason said. I toured two facilities. One was a Lutheran Social Services facility in Spearfish, and another one was in Rapid City. What I found was that it looked to me like the children that were there were being well cared for. The people that were in charge were absolutely interested in educating and trying to get them back to their parents as soon as possible. The facilities contain children as young as the age of 10. Which is really disturbing that someone that young is involved in such a situation or problems that they are put in a facility. But the thing that I found somewhat disturbing when I was talking to the staff in both facilities, I asked the question. I said, "What is your staff turnover rate?" In one facility, they were very pleased that it was down to 50%. The other facility, when I asked them the same question, they just shook their head and mumbled something about 70-80%. You know, this I think is a problem that, you know, part of the reason for this, of course, is the pay scale. These people do not get paid what they should, what they need. It's a tough place to work when you're dealing with children as young as 10 year olds, and I would compliment staff that have stayed there. We actually found one individual that had been there for 5 years. You know, that's longevity in that kind of business, but it's something that we need to to take a look at. You know, budget restraints and everything else. When you're dealing with the lives of young children like this, we need to really make sure that they have the best care that they can. The facility in Spearfish was a new facility. It was convenient for the students. They were actually doing some renovating. The facility in Rapid City needed to be expanded and updated. So this was a real eye-opener for me. I have a whole different outlook on these facilities. I didn't know that either one of them existed. I'm really glad that I had the opportunity to go through and look at them. But I do have a concern for the children based on the fact that the turnover in those two facilities is unacceptable.
Thank you. Any other comments? Okay, with that, thank you so very much.
Welcome.
Moving on, retirement laws is still going to meet, so we don't have a final report. Rules review.
Good afternoon. Doug Decker, Code Counsel. I'm staff to the Rules Review Committee. The Rules Review Committee has met six times this interim. It will meet two more times before the interim is concluded, one time later this week, and the last meeting on December 20th to wind up their operations for the interim. They're statutorily created, and they are authorized to review every rule that each agency or licensing board promulgates during the year. It's very busy. This is one committee that has utilized the DDN network to the fullest extent possible, and it's been, by and large, working quite well. We've had a couple of hiccups, but we're working through that. It helps the legislators and the members of the public attend. They don't have to travel all the way to Pierre. They can. We usually have a meeting place in Rapid, Huron, Yankton, Aberdeen, and Sioux Falls, and Pierre, so it works out quite well because that's where the committee members are from. The business of the committee was mainly routine review of things such as licensing for game fish and parks, park entrance fees, insurance regulation, social services regulation, things of that nature. The professional and occupational licensing boards regularly appear with changes to their regulatory schemes. One rule from the Department of Social Services was reverted to a prior step in the process. That's one of the tools that are available to the committee when, in the opinion of the committee, based on testimony and other input that the committee has received, that if the rule needs to be reworked based on comment or the rule is attempting to accomplish, the committee can ask the agency to take this rule back to an earlier step in the rule adoption process so that members of the public or other interested parties can present additional information and the legislature exercises oversight in that way to make sure that the rule accomplishes what the agency intends to accomplish and the needs of the public are also met. Mainly the people that are regulated by that rule have an opportunity to make sure it accomplishes the goal. The committee will have one bill this year, and it relates to that reversion process. You recall last year there was some controversy regarding unreasonable expenses imposed by rules upon units of local government, and a bill was introduced, and this is not a rejection of that, but a modification of it so that the work of the interim committee and the use of the reversion tool fits better with how the committee functions. And that's what the bill will do. It allows for a reversion if there is a belief that there are unreasonable costs imposed. And with that, I'll stand by for questions.
Thank you. Representative Putnam.
Thank you. I was reading through one of the, blue sheets here, and I looked up and I saw Mr. Decker, and I said, whoop, there's where I want to ask the question, so I apologize for interfering with your code commission prior. I guess I don't know enough about it, but it does sound like I would ask this before you go to the statutes. Do you not have the authority now to revert, whether it's unreasonable or not, based on your own committee membership?
Well, there are seven statutory, I believe it's seven statutory requirements that would allow a revert. No, I take that back. There's eight currently. This bill will add nine. And this makes it clear that if there are unreasonable costs, it may be reverted. I think with looking at some of the other steps or other rationale that are provided in statute that would allow reversion, they don't cleanly fit. This makes it explicitly clear in statute that it can be reverted for this reason, and so it's viewed as a better result.
Representative Cronin.
What would an unreasonable cost be categorized as?
Well, that's a good question, and that would be based upon the testimony that is received by the committee. It would be such a thing as it may increase a budgetary expenditure by an amount that the current taxing structure or the current budget would not support. There, you know, any number of reasons like that that can be articulated by the person who is proposing that this is unreasonable. They would have the opportunity to present the rationale to support that conclusion. And if in the judgment of the Rules Review Committee they agreed, then it would be subject to a motion by the committee to revert the rule to a prior step for either additional hearings or reconsideration of the need for that particular requirement.
Representative Putnam.
Thank you. When you revert, it doesn't necessarily mean it turns everything backwards, but do you get a choice on the Rules Committee? Because I've not served on there, but do you have the choice on the Rules Committee to decide if it goes back to a certain step that you would call for? For example, could you go back to a step in the public policy or the public hearings or bypass a couple? Is there an opportunity to do that under your statute? Is that what you have in mind?
But the reversion process, the way it has worked in the past, there's two ways that it usually occurs. One, you can send, if it's a department secretary reconsidering something, and the commentary that's received at the committee may be sufficiently clear where the Rules Review Committee could revert it back to a department secretary to rewrite a rule based upon the comments received. If it is not, there really isn't consensus on what the revision should be, it's common to revert to another public hearing, to revert it to a public hearing so that the interested persons can come in and say, here's how we would like to see this rule read, and the proponents and opponents can hash it out in a public fashion and then reach a consensus and then bring the rule back. So it can work in two ways.
I probably not need to pursue this more, maybe with some of the committee members, but I do recall some years ago the Rules Committee did, or at least strongly advised the Department of Education not to do a certain rule because it had something to do with the amount of monies that could be moved around. But I just when I first read this, it sounded like, you know, the Rules Committee is somehow saying what the costs or what the expenses are going to be to somebody out there, and I just didn't understand it. I don't know if I still understand it, but I thank you for the information, and I'm sure we'll talk more on it with committee members over there.
I'm just going to comment here, since I sit and vice chair that committee. You know, this came about as in this legislative session, as Mr. Decker had explained. What came out was that a piece of legislation passed that had a financial impact on counties or local government. And because it passed, not knowing what the implications were going to be or the financial implications, in some counties, there was concern that they were being mandated without having dollars it was an unfunded mandate. That was the perception. So a piece of legislation was passed that said, basically, that you couldn't do that if it was an unfunded. So the debate we have, well, is it unfunded? Do we know? Now, I'm going to lead off to a discussion that we had in appropriations on Friday where one of the members raised the question, and this was that this was the Department of Social Services, that we had approved their budget and in the general bill, when we approved the appropriations bill, that was approved, and the approved was that providers in certain sectors were all impacted, but some were impacted on the type of the formula that was going to be used to reimburse them, that it would be negative to them. When we had the rules hearing, those providers came forth and stated what the implications were going to be on this and how it was going to impact services. At that point in time, we felt that there was enough public testimony or support to stop what we had approved in the appropriations process and send it back or revert it to a prior step, which would have been for the department to relook at it. The department so chose then not to take the rule and take it back and revise it, but just exist as they did. But the question that came up in appropriations was, if the legislature passed the appropriations bill, if you did all this, why is Rules Committee now saying that they won't support that when it was the intent of the legislature to do that? And it came up in appropriations, and I felt that was not the discussion place for this. In thinking about that, you know, over time, it's like, well, what's the point of rules? I mean, it is a process for the constituents, for the citizens to have one more opportunity to assess that information and what the impact would be. Is that right or wrong? I don't know, but that's how we have played it out, that if you have people that come and testify at interim rules, that they raise a concern that maybe wasn't voiced, or maybe as we didn't understand that, or some of us did, some of us didn't, and that's how it got to play. So that question is out there sort of with this unreasonable cost. If the legislature, on that first piece of legislation, that was with the PSAPs, and they're coming to interim rules on Wednesday, and they have met with the parties involved, and I believe they've negotiated a deal now, how those expenses or what options local governments have to provide that service. Had we not done that or had reverted it back, then local government would have maybe not done this. There would be some new monies that had to be generated at the local level. So, you know, is this a process? This is a way that we can do it. It delays it. It doesn't say we're not going to do it, but maybe you're getting some additional information that wasn't there to begin with. And that seems to be the piece out there that, you know, we all have been where we do vote on things, and, you know, sometimes after you vote and something goes through, you sometimes see the final implications on that, and you wonder, gee, did I have all the pieces of information? And so by offering it at one more time for a hearing, if it's a rule change, it does give those parties affected to come back and provide information. So that's sort of where the arena is that we came up on Rules Committee, that we needed at least a definite, that we had it in our rule, that we could send it back to a prior, because it was sort of not clear. Could you not? And somebody could challenge and say, well, why did you do it? At least this way we now have a rationale or a reason to put back the process. That's just a long background of how this sort of has surfaced. And if it comes to, you know, if we do propose this legislation, you'll certainly be able to act on it during session and get more information on the piece of it. And the other piece may come up if the legislature in totality approves something, and that's what rules is about. You approve something, but we're still doing a check and balance on it to make sure it's the intent that that's what we all were looking at. Any questions or comments? Thank you. Our last one is State Tribal Affairs. I will also ask, I understand you're going to present an issue memo after this. Third also, we'll just follow after this. Thank you.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the board, State Tribal Relations Committee met.
You want to identify yourself for the home launch.
Sorry. I'm Tom Magadance, and I staff State Tribal Relations Committee. The committee was created in 1993 as a statutory interim committee as part of state's reconciliation efforts and has been ongoing since then. Members of the committee are appointed for two-year terms, and the current membership is just finishing their 2 years. New members will be chosen at the next session for 2011 and 2012. Senator Bradford has been the chair the last 2 years, and the vice chair is Representative Junkie. Senator Teason is also a member of the committee. The committee generally follows the same format as other interim studies, three regular meetings over a five-day span. Sometimes our schedule gets a little different. Sometimes we meet during session from time to time, but basically it acts like other interim study committees. We had a short informational kind of planning meeting during session on March 10th in Pierre when everyone was still here for fourth session to discuss possible summer study topics, whether we wanted to hold meetings on any of the reservations. We also had a couple of presentations at that meeting. Basically, it was to prepare for the upcoming interim. Our first regular meeting was June 17th in Pierre. We heard several presentations from state agencies on issues affecting Native Americans. Charlie McGuigan from the Attorney General's office gave a very good presentation on land issues and jurisdiction issues in Indian country, and it really clarified a lot of things, a lot of questions that members had. It's been a long time since we've had that presentation, and it's good background information. Department of Corrections updated the committee programs and the situation in the correctional system as it affects Native Americans and the Native American population, including activities and programs that they have that are directed toward Native Americans. The Office of Indian Education has a new director, Luann Wardell. She briefed the committee on her position and some of the activities that they have going on. We also took public testimony at that meeting. The second regular meeting was held September 23rd, 24th in Sisseton and Agency Village. I was pleased with that meeting. I thought it went very well. The Sisseton Wahpin tribe usually does a very good job of organizing these things and putting them together. They basically had presentations that filled the entire day from tribal officials, tribal offices, tribal programs. The second part of that, the next day we toured a number of facilities in Sisseton and Agency Village. Sisseton Wahpeton has three casinos. They have one fairly large, very nice one north of Watertown, a few miles. They have another one that's smaller, just across the interstate from the town of Sisseton, and that kind of serves the local population. And then they have one just across the North Dakota line, which is a very large casino. And Sisseton, Wahpeton, and also Standing Rock are the two tribes that have casinos both in North and South Dakota. And in North Dakota, they're not subject to the machine limits that they are in South Dakota, so that issue always comes up for discussion. In addition to touring those, we did not tour the North Dakota casino, but we toured the other two. We also toured the Woodrow Wilson Keeble Memorial Health Center in Sisseton, the Law Enforcement Center, the Elderly Center. We toured Dakota Western Manufacturing Plant, which is kind of impressive. It's a going concern. It's been in operation for 20 years. What they make plastic bags. Plastic garbage bags is what they make, which doesn't sound all that interesting, but actually it's a pretty interesting place to see. They have a contract with McDonald's, and when you throw your trash away at McDonald's, it's into a bag that comes from Sisseton, Wahpeton, Sioux Tribe. We also toured Sisseton Wahpeton College and Teos Pazina Tribal School, so it was a full day, and I thought it was a pretty good meeting. We did not adopt any legislation, and that's pretty standard for the committee. Usually the state tribal does not have legislation. We will have one more half-day meeting December 6th in Pierre, the day before the governor's budget address, to address some things that came up in the Sisseton meeting. The chair wanted to do that, and we still have a little space available as to how many days we've used. And that's all I have for state tribal, if there are any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Senator Teason?
Just to add a couple of quick comments, maybe. Service on this committee can be both fulfilling and frustrating, often in the same day and sometimes even in the same conversation, I think. You know, in most most relationships between tribal government is with the federal government, but there's an amazing number of relationships and agreements between tribal government and state government. And I think that, you know, the name of this committee is Tribal Relations, and it really is all about relationships. And usually every year we accept an invitation to travel to one of the reservations in South Dakota. And I think it's always an eye-opener for the committee members that attend it. Again, keeping those relationships open. I know that there have been days, committee days, where I felt kind of frustrated at the end, and then the next day I talked to people on the other side that were extremely grateful for the opportunity to meet and discuss and present issues to the committee. So I think it's an important committee for the legislature to have to sort of maintain these open lines of communications with tribal members and with tribal government. It's always an interesting time. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else? Okay, thank you. Your second piece?
Okay. I'll discuss the issue memo, South Dakota Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. At the April meeting, the E-Board instructed LRC to do an issue memo to study the potential creation of a Department of Veterans Affairs as a cabinet-level department. Currently, what we have is the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, which includes the National Guard and the Adjutant General and the command structure for the National Guard, as well as the Division of Veterans Affairs, which deals with veterans issues, and then the State Veterans Home and some other things. The proposal was, or there's been proposals floated, I guess, to create a separate Department of Veterans Affairs as a cabinet-level department, and I tried to look at that. Began by doing a basic history and overview of the department and its functions which are included in the paper. Got a lot of information from the department itself. In particular, they did a really extensive survey of other states as to, you know, do other states have a standalone veterans department, or do they have is it cabinet level, or are they combined? What's their budget? How many employees do they have? It was a pretty extensive survey and was very helpful. Also looked at old statutes, old legislation, and also at material from other states. In terms of just recent issues and legislation dealing with Veterans Affairs, in the last few years there have been several bills on dealing with qualifications of the division or the director of the Division of Veterans Affairs and also of veteran service officers in the counties. There has been a bill or two on the composition of the Veterans Commission in terms of number of members or the role of veterans organizations in the Veterans Commission. When you look at other states, almost all states have a Veterans Commission. There's a huge amount of variety state to state as to how those are put together. I mean, some of them have a list of 20 different veterans organizations that they pick their members from. So, I mean, it's all over the board. There have also been a couple of bills to study the creation of a separate Department of Veterans Affairs, and that's what led to this issue memo. There are 33 states that have a standalone Veterans Department, Veterans Affairs Department, separate from their National Guard. Of these, 19 are cabinet level. So we've got 31 states that do not have cabinet level departments and 17 that do not have separate departments. The usual other method is to combine them like we do. In looking at this, I mean, I try to not, or we don't take a position and try to be even-handed and so on. In looking at this, I think that there were three things that struck me as being maybe pertinent to the discussion that I hadn't really thought about before. First, South Dakota had a Veterans Department previously from 1944 to 1973. What happened is before that, it was sort of haphazard. You'd have various veterans benefits or a bonus or something for after World War I or the Spanish-American War or something like that. World War II was so huge, and so many people went. In 1944, the legislature had a special session strictly to look at how we're going to deal with all the veterans who are going to be coming back in the next few months. And in the 1944 special session created the Veterans Commission, pretty much as it is today. The membership is a little different, but the Veterans Commission has been in place since then. It also created the South Dakota Veterans Department as a separate department. Now, in the meantime, we've always had an adjutant general and a National Guard, even dating back to territorial times, but it wasn't really organized as a separate department. In 1955, the Department of Military Affairs was created under the direction of the adjutant general, and that was strictly to run the National Guard. Now, they had recently added the Air National Guard to the National Guard. It was a bigger group, and they thought that a department would be helpful. So from 55 to 73, we had two separate departments, one to deal with military affairs and the Guard, and the other to deal with veterans affairs. In 1973, there was a large-scale government reorganization, which was done by executive order. The two departments were combined as part of that process. I don't think that there was a particular issue that the public was overly concerned about at that time where we had to deal with the military question here. It was just part of the overall large-scale government reorganization. So since 1973, it's been the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Adjutant General is the head, and it is a cabinet-level department, but it includes both the Guard and the Division of Veterans Affairs. Another area to look at is to use the data that the department came up with and compare with other states. And when you do that, again, they're all over the board. If there's any kind of trend that I can see, it's that generally the larger, more urban states are maybe more likely to have standalone departments and larger budgets and so on. But there are a lot of exceptions to that, too. There's not really a good guideline here, I don't think. It's kind of interesting to look at the surrounding states. The states that border South Dakota are quite similar, except Minnesota is very different. But in terms of budget and employees that these Veterans Affairs offices or departments have, they're very similar. They're all in the range of $1 million to $1.5 million a year, except Minnesota. Employees, North Dakota has 7, South Dakota has 17, Wyoming 12, Montana 30, Nebraska 18, Minnesota has 1,300. And I add the budgets. Minnesota has $116 million budget. Now, I think what's going on there is Minnesota has 5 veterans homes, and they also may have a lot of state employees working at local level offices. But taking out Minnesota and looking at the other states, are all quite similar. Half of them have standalone departments. Half of them have combined departments. Iowa is standalone cabinet level. North Dakota is standalone, not cabinet level. Nebraska is standalone cabinet level. Minnesota is standalone department cabinet level. Montana, Wyoming, South Dakota, Colorado are not standalone departments. They're combined. So it's hard to draw a pattern there or to say this is how we ought to go based on looking at other states. The other point that I think is interesting, and I hope I'm not overstepping my bounds here, but currently the National Guard and the National Guard command structure and the AG are involved in a lot more veterans issues than they used to be. The reason is since 1990, when we had Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm, there were huge call-ups of National Guard people. We hadn't had anything like that really since World War II or partly the Korean War. There was a long period in between where Guard units really weren't activated. A Guard member is not a veteran under federal or state law unless they're called to active federal service. Nowadays, with all the deployments that we've had in Iraq and Afghanistan and in the Balkans in the 90s and the first Gulf War, there are many, many veterans in National Guard units. And it's not just like it used to be where if you had a veteran in a National Guard unit, it was a guy who was in the service before and then joined the Guard. There are people who their first enlistment is in the Guard, but they're veterans. And the Guard structure is very much involved in taking care of their people, I think. And the Military and Veterans Affairs currently is a cabinet-level department. So it's to me, that's another factor, I guess, in considering whether or not you want to have a separate department or what's the best way to structure this. Would a separate department improve access for veterans to the governor and to upper-level decision makers? Maybe. I'm not sure. I think there are arguments on both sides. I'm sure that there's some extra cost with it, not a lot. A lot of these things are already in place. But, you know, I'm not sure which way is the best way to go. I think there are good arguments both ways. LRC doesn't take a position on this. Hopefully the information in the issue memo and some of the data there is helpful to you. I guess I take questions.
I assume there will be a hard document of this available to the committee.
I think they were mailed to the committee.
I didn't see it. No, I don't know. Is it online?
No. If it's not, it will be soon. But
Madam Chair, I just checked there to our website. There were the issue memorandums. And it's not there.
Okay. I know that we're.
What's the preference of the committee? We need to make a motion to accept the reports, and this issue memorandum would be one of those reports. Do you want a hard copy before you do that? I guess it's just facts. It's not any recommendation. Senator Gray?
Madam Chair, I don't think it's going to probably change the report any. It's not going to change our response any. I would move approval of the report.
Second.
I'm just going to ask you, is that this report or all the reports that we've
all
had?
Reports.
All the reports. Thank you. It's been moved by Senator Gray for approval of all the reports as presented, seconded by Representative Rave. Any discussion on that motion? Representative Tiedemann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now, will we get a copy of that report if we can get it before we leave? It's got some excellent information. Thank you very much. But the historical perspective is very good. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Any other comments? Okay. We will get a hard copy before we leave today. All those in favor of adoption of the reports as presented, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion carried. Thank you very much. With that, we'll move into the next item, which is agency interim review. On your agenda packet, you have a listing of the agencies that have been reviewed, and you also have the agencies that are remaining, BFM, Department of Health, and Department of Human Services. Mr. Fries has a comment.